Herzlich willkommen and welcome to our new English language episode of History and Politics, the Körber Stiftung's podcast dealing with the multiple ways in which the past matters for current affairs. I'm Gabrielle Wojdelko and I'm very happy to host this episode. Almost 1.5 years into Russia's invasion of Ukraine, I have spoken to Mary Elise Sorotti, who is one of the leading post-Cold War historians from the US. Mary Sorotti holds the Kravis Chair at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C., and in 2022 she has published a major historical study of NATO Eastern Enlargement. The book, as you may know, is entitled Not One Inch, America, Russia and the Making of the Post-Cold War Stalemate. And the German edition of this book is to be published in autumn 2023. So for those of you who are interested in the German version. In my conversation with Mary, we discussed what went wrong after 1989, 1991. We also discussed if NATO could and should have had a different strategy towards Ukraine when it discussed its major eastern enlargement almost 20 years ago, and how to find a new language for the era we are in since February 2022. Because Zeitenwende is a process, but it's not yet a definition for this current new age of war and confrontation that started with Russia's war against Ukraine. So if you are curious to find out whether we managed to find a new term for this new era and what were the major turning points in Russia's relationship with the West in the last 3 decades, stay with us and tune in to our conversation for the next roughly 35 minutes. Dear listeners, we are recording this podcast in Hamburg at the venue of Körber Stiftung on the 24th of May 2023, and we have construction works going on in our building. And if during listening to our episode you hear noises that are linked to construction works, please accept my apologies for that. We couldn't make the construction workers stop their work. Sorry for that. Mary, we are recording this episode of History and Politics 15 months into the war that Russia has launched against Ukraine. You are one of the most known Cold War historians, and welcome to History and Politics, Mary.
Thank you so much. Honored to be here. I'm just sorry it's for such a sad reason.
As I said, you are a very famous Cold War historian. You have researched and written extensively about this period that started in the late 1940s, and we thought that it ended in 1989-1991. And last year, when Russia invaded Ukraine, you have written a piece in New York Times, and I quote from that, you said, back then, I fear that Russia's invasion, regardless of its outcome, portends a new era of immense hostility with Moscow. And that is that this new Cold War will be far worse than the first. So my question to you is, now after 1.5 years into the war, do you still think that the term new Cold War fits to what we are observing?
Well, I'm pleased that we are not discussing today Russia's use of a nuclear weapon in this conflict. That would, of course, be a complete disaster. My biggest worry at the beginning of the full-scale invasion was that it could escalate to some kind of a nuclear conflict. And I am obviously very, very pleased that such a terrible event hasn't happened. I do think, however, that we are now in an era of immense hostility with Russia. In that regard, what is happening does resemble the previous Cold War. There are, of course, major differences. The biggest difference, of course, being that the world is not bipolar in the way it used to be. Of course, China is a major factor. This conflict is also not an ideological conflict in the way that it was during the Cold War. Putin wants to recreate many aspects of the Russian past, of the Soviet past, but he does not want to recreate communism.
That's a very interesting point. You've mentioned the nuclear threat. We'll come back to that. But right now you said Putin wants to recreate many aspects of the Soviet past. Many people, when discussing about Russia's invasion, say that it's pure imperialism that drives Putin. So not so much the Soviet past, but even further back. I mean, it's a 19th century ideology, early 20th century ideology that has led to many bloody conflicts and war in history. And what would you say? I mean, is it like this imperialist ideology that from the 19th century that you see as a major driving force, or is it rather the, let's say, the Soviet imperialism that drives him?
Both.
Okay.
As a historian, I like to tell my students, the one phenomenon that I have never observed is monocausality. In other words, major events have multiple origins. So what's clear to me is that Putin is obsessed with the past. He, on top of everything else, had the worst work-from-home experience ever during the pandemic, as my friend Andrew Weiss likes to say. He, as far as we can tell, sat more or less in isolation and obsessed over history, and particularly obsessed over those times that he felt Russia lost unfairly. And now he wants to refight these historical battles, only this time with Russia winning. And those battles go back to, as you said, the era of Russian Empire, but they also include Soviet examples. And they even include post-Cold War examples, such as the fight over NATO enlargement. You mentioned at the beginning that I'm a Cold War historian, and that's true. But increasingly, I'm a historian of the post-Cold War era, especially since that era is now over. An interesting question is when it ended. Mm-hmm. Reasonable people can disagree about that, but it is over. And it ended at the very latest with the full-scale invasion of Ukraine on February 24th, 2022. So Putin is interested in refighting battles from before the Cold War, during the Cold War, and after the Cold War.
Okay, that's what you meant when you talked about the multiple causes.
Yes.
So there is not one driving factor only. Let's come back to the differences between the old Cold War and the new Cold War. You have already started to talk about that at the beginning. Would you say that the major difference is the nuclear threat that you have in mind when you talk about the new Cold War? Because the nuclear threat is what remains with us.
Yes.
We can see that.
Yes.
Is the nuclear factor the main issue for the new Cold War?
Well, just to emphasize again, the phrase new Cold War is problematic. So I tend to use, as I did in my New York Times article, the less elegant but more accurate phrase that we're in a period of immense hostility with Russia. The reason I hesitate a little bit to use new Cold War is because there are serious differences. As mentioned before, the old Cold War was very ideological, mm-hmm. capitalism versus communism. Putin is not trying to recreate communism. The old Cold War was strongly bipolar. Now, obviously, the world is different. China is obviously a huge economic superpower. India is about to become the most populous nation on earth, I believe, or is obviously a huge factor in its own right. So there's that difference as well. The nuclear factor, by contrast, is a strong continuity. Mm-hmm. Often my students, I'm a professor, I teach, my students have this sort of vague sense that the nuclear weapons went away at the end of the Cold War, which obviously did not happen. Russia and the United States are still, more than 30 years after the end of the Cold War, the only strategic nuclear powers. That means they can basically end civilization, certainly, and end most life on Earth. The strategic atomic arsenals that would do that, they're, you know, it would be the time from their launch to their detonation would be measured in minutes. I think that we've lost a societal awareness of that risk. What's happening now is, in some senses, a return of history. Mm-hmm. Great power competition in Europe has reignited. Mm-hmm. Danger levels are escalating. And so we're having, tragically, to relearn many historical lessons. What it means to fight a great power war in Europe, what it means to use conventional weapons, which is what have been used so far, what it might mean if tactical nuclear weapons were used, what it might mean if that fighting then escalated. We're having to relearn all these military topics that we thought belonged to history. Now, I, as a historian, was still familiar with them, mm-hmm. but they're no longer part of normal societal discourse. That's changing.
Do you see, that's interesting, because I'm a German by citizenship, and especially we in Germany, we, for historical reasons, we didn't have many strategic discussions throughout the last couple of years. Do you see a difference between different European countries? I mean, often it is said Germany doesn't have a strategic culture anymore. We are not used to these kind of debates. Is it different in other countries?
Well, let me actually say something first about Germany. There were in Germany, I think, two dominant beliefs, and these, I think, are reasonable beliefs. So one belief was that Putin would not start a major war against Ukraine because it would not be in his own interest. It would not be in Russia's interest. It would be economically so damaging that he simply wouldn't do it. He would have enough interest in self-preservation and in preservation of the Russian economy not to do it. So that was one belief. That's a reasonable belief. Another belief was what is encapsulated in the German phrase Wandel durch Handel. So mm-hmm. for your non-German speaking audience members, the idea that you can influence a country by trading with it, by establishing contacts mm-hmm. that are of mutual interest. Mm-hmm. Those are, I think, both things that reasonable people can agree on. The problem is when you have such an extreme figure like Putin, who's willing to do things that are not in his own interest out of rage at the feeling that Russia has unjustly lost in the past, then suddenly those aren't compelling enough. And then it's clear that, you know, you have to think differently because you are dealing with someone who is willing to go to extremes, even extremes that violate his own self-interest. And there, I think the German discussion was different than in some other countries. The Baltics and so forth mm-hmm. had more of a sense of his willingness to go to extremes. In fact, I actually remembered a very interesting Kerber event in Warsaw in December 2022. There was an interesting discussion among military officers. I won't say the names because it was under mm-hmm. Chatham House rules, but the gist of the discussion was as follows. Before the beginning of the full-scale invasion, there were three tribes in NATO. The first tribe was the countries that border Russia. They all said, we are living in a zone of existential threat mm-hmm. because Russia will go to extremes and we need to deal with this and be prepared for it. The second zone was the countries of Southeastern Europe who were saying, we live in a zone of acute threat because of immigration. That's the second zone or tribe. Mm-hmm. And the third tribe, which was the bulk of NATO, everybody else believed they were living in a zone of eternal peace. Mm-hmm. And the three tribes basically couldn't really talk to each other. And now what's happened is there's a realization that tribes one and two had a point, especially tribe one. And those tribes, their thinking, which, as you said, you know, what was the thinking in other countries like, that their thinking actually was relevant in this extreme case. And so now that Zeitenwende in Germany, the transition time, is also a Gedankenwende, changing of thoughts. And so now you're finding these three tribes are able to talk to each other, and the German thinking is coming closer to other countries.
Yes, definitely. There is a major change within the German public debate and also within the perception. There was an interesting point, as you are a historian and we are talking, and with historians, it's always tempting to talk about periods and periodization.
Yes.
I read an interesting quote from you. You said that we thought that the Soviet Union fell apart in 1991. But now we, that means the different tribes, but maybe most prominently the tribe to which Germany belonged, and that the tribe that thought we are living in eternal peace, we have to learn that the process of falling apart of the USSR continues until today. I mean, we are still observing that the war against Ukraine is a process of the disintegration of the Soviet Union. Would you say that?
Yes, absolutely. My colleague Michael Kaufman, who's an expert in Russian military strategy, has argued that what we're seeing now is the latest in a series of wars of Soviet succession. And I think he's right in saying that. Empires don't disappear in a day. Even though the Soviet Union, in theory, ceased to exist on December 25th, 1991, that's, of course, the day Gorbachev resigned as the last leader of the Soviet Union. In reality, empires take a while to disintegrate, mm-hmm. and people fight the whole time it's happening. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing now. Unfortunately, it's escalated, right? At first, there was the relatively short conflict in Georgia. Then there was the annexation of Crimea. Now we have the full-scale invasion. It's the process, unfortunately, has been getting bloodier.
Thank you very much, Mary. You already touched upon, let's say, turning points, or as you said, succession wars. And you talked about Georgia, that was obviously 2008, and annexation of Crimea, 2014. But to me, when we think about Russia and what we got wrong about Russia under Putin, what about the Chechen wars as a turning point that we maybe have overlooked? I mean, would you agree that the Chechen wars were, to a certain extent, the playbook for what has followed? Or to put it short, if we look at what happened in Grozny and if we look at what happened in Mariupol, can we see similarities?
Yeah, so I do believe that the Chechen wars are an important precursor, and I believe they are also part of this process we've been discussing, the wars of Soviet succession. That's why it's plural, right? There obviously were extensive disagreements over where the borders should be and fighting over that. And so you could basically compile a list. It starts exactly as you said in Chechnya, which was more significant than we thought at the time. And then it continues in other regions, most prominently in Georgia in 2008. And then there's the annexation of Crimea in 2014. And then there's the full-scale invasion in 2022. And in hindsight, we see a continuity there that we didn't recognize at the time.
And obviously, we, that means the Western countries, NATO, whoever, we didn't react properly, because especially from my point of view as a German citizen, I could say that there were a lot of attempts still after 2014 to appease Putin, to appease Russia, the Minsk process, this whole idea of having negotiations in order to settle the conflict, to freeze it, to find a compromise. If you look into Putin's essays and into what he has laid out about his policies in hindsight, it was all there as early as late 90s. So why didn't we see that? Why didn't we? What is your explanation?
So I would be a little bit careful with the word appease, because obviously that's a hot button word. But there is very much a continuity. He is clearly willing to use violence, to use escalation of conflicts to achieve his goals. That's something in the West we don't usually consider. Usually we try to de-escalate conflicts. But Putin realized there are ways to force the matter by escalating conflicts, and sometimes that can be useful. I think it's important to remember that there was genuine cooperation between a newly democratic Russia and the West in the 90s. for example, in the area of nuclear disarmament.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
In fact, that was the greatest era of nuclear disarmament since the invention of the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. The Russian leaders and the American leaders worked hand in hand, not only to pull back, but actually to destroy strategic nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. Russia also democratized. Obviously, it was an imperfect democracy, but speaking as an American, you know, it's hard to find a perfect democracy. We're obviously having trouble in America with populism and the January 6th insurrection, but Russia did democratize. There were elections that were largely free. So it's important to remember that there was a moment of democratization and cooperation. And so it's perhaps not surprising that, you know, initially when there are these conflicts that are that are like between the Russians and the Chechens, that's an area obviously where there's, you know, there's no NATO guarantees or anything like that. It's understandable there's an inclination not to try to get involved there. But by the time you get to 2008, by that point, Putin has given his famous speech at the Munich Security Conference where he's indicated he's not going to tolerate any further NATO enlargement. Mm-hmm. And then when 2008 rolls around and he actually begins violence against Georgia, that I think was a moment where the West could have reacted more strongly. Mm-hmm. Of course, it came together with Olympics in Beijing, and the world wanted to celebrate the Olympics and you know, hoped that this wouldn't get worse. Mm-hmm. So 2008, I think, has been underestimated in its importance. Mm-hmm. Then came 2014, annexation of Crimea. I think really at that point, that was where, you know, in the West, we should have said, wait a minute, this is starting to be a pattern. So I'm not sure if I would say it was appeasement in the 90s, but then by the time, you know, you get to annexation of Crimea, even there, he had a little bit of an excuse because it was not technically Russians. It was little green men. In other words, men wearing uniforms without insignia, right? He was, you know, he wasn't so audacious then, but obviously now it's going on. It's very, very clear. Mm-hmm. So I think it was a process, but we could have recognized earlier in the process, you know, what the direction of travel was for German listeners, die Fahrrichtung.
Yeah. You have already mentioned, or we have already mentioned, NATO a couple of times in our conversation. Let's dig a bit deeper. When we look at the late 90s, early 2000s, and when we look at what happened in NATO and with NATO then, I mean, it was obvious that after 89, 91, there was a need to develop an international security order fit for the new geopolitical situation with the Soviet Union falling apart, and what to do with the successor states and what to do with the former Warsaw Pact states. Do you think that the international institutions such as NATO did well enough to really develop new strategies for these new times?
Yeah. Obviously, this brings up the question of NATO enlargement. And as many of your readers may know, I've published a book about that called Not One Inch, America, Russia, and the Making of Post-Cold War Stalemate. We could perhaps provide a link for your...
Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, exactly. And that book will be appearing for your German listeners this fall with Beck as Nicht einen Schritt weiter nach Osten. Mm-hmm. And in, I mentioned that book because I want to summarize the argument there. Mm-hmm. In the book, I make clear that I support NATO enlargement. Mm-hmm. The former Warsaw Pact countries became democracies, became market economies, sharing the values of NATO, which is both a military alliance and an alliance of countries that share values. They had every right to apply for membership. NATO had every right to take them. So I am not opposed to NATO enlargement. My quarrel is with how it happened. Mm-hmm. It's a mistake to think of NATO enlargement as one thing. There were multiple ways to enlarge NATO. Previous NATO members had different kinds of memberships. So, for example, Norway as the only original member to share a border with the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Norway negotiated for itself a kind of special kind of membership where in peacetime it would not have foreign troops on its land or in its ports, and also that it would not have nuclear weapons. That's just one example. There are also special aspects to the membership for Denmark, for France, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So there are different ways to take on members, and members could have different conditions. After the Cold War ended, when post-Cold War NATO enlargement was starting, I think those precedents would have been better than what actually happened. Mm-hmm. What actually happened was all or nothing. All or nothing NATO enlargement. And the irony is that President Bill Clinton initially saw the problem there. When countries came to him and said, you know, this is in the early 1990s, we want to be in NATO right away, Clinton responded, and this I saw in the documents that I declassified, Clinton responded, I understand you want to be in NATO right away, but we just erased the Cold War line across Europe. Why should we immediately draw a new Article 5 line? Mm-hmm. If I give you all of Article 5 and the post-Soviet states nothing, we've just drawn a new line across Europe. And you countries of Central and Eastern Europe, you of all countries should understand what it means for us in the West to draw a line and leave countries outside of it. And then he said, in particular, I practically fell out of my chair as I'm reading this in the documents, in particular, if we draw a new line across Europe now in the early 90s, we will leave Ukraine on the wrong side alone with Russia. Mm-hmm. Right? Ukraine back then was a country of over 50 million people, so roughly as large as Britain. It also briefly was the third biggest nuclear power in the world because of the amount of Soviet arsenal still on its territory. That arsenal was controlled from Moscow, but it was physically on Ukrainian mm-hmm. territory. And so Clinton specifically said, we don't want to leave Ukraine alone with Russia.
Okay, but this is what has happened.
Right, exactly, yes. So I should say I'm paraphrasing, but the exact quotations are in the book, Not One Inch, and mm-hmm. will be in the German version, Nicht einen Schritt weiter. And so that was exactly my question, because as I was reading the documents, mm-hmm. I found myself agreeing very much with that assessment. Mm-hmm. And so Clinton said, we need to, initially, he said, we need to find a way to create some kind of European security organization in which Russia and Ukraine and post-Soviet states can be members. Then that won't draw an immediate new line. And then what we can do is then within that organization, we can then gradually promote countries to NATO membership over time. But there won't immediately be this hard line. And that program was initially called the Partnership for Peace, mm-hmm. which began work in 1994 and was even more successful than people thought it would be. But then, unfortunately, tragically, Russia made several big self-harming mistakes, which is a theme in Russian history, right? We're seeing mm-hmm. now with Putin, what he's doing is hurts himself very much, hurts Russia very much, but he's still doing it. So Yeltsin, in late 1993, decided to use bloodshed in politics again. Mm-hmm. In late 1993, he had tanks fire at his own parliament, and there were something like 800 casualties, both killed and injured. Even worse, in 1994, he invaded Chechnya.
Exactly.
So that was very insightful of you to ask about Chechnya, because it really connects to the story. And so then countries in Central and Eastern Europe said, okay, we heard what you said before. We understand that we didn't want to leave post-Soviet states on their own. But now the situation is different. Mm-hmm. Now Moscow is killing people again. Mm-hmm. Now we believe we really do need to get into NATO proper. And so there's a split in the interests of Central and Eastern Europeans and the post-Soviet states.
That's quite interesting, because when you said you would agree to the initial argument that Bill Clinton made
yes.
at the time.
Yes.
This brings me to, I have read a recent piece written by Fiona Hill, the American security expert
yes.
who has advised the U.S. government on security issues. And she also said that NATO's biggest failure in the 1990s was to concentrate on the integration of the former Warsaw Pact states and the three Baltic republics that regained their independence from Soviet Union, but to avoid implementing the Partnership for Peace. And so I grasp that you would agree to that.
Yes.
So let me put the question a bit more, let's say, precisely, do you think that Russia's war against Georgia in 2008 and its war against Ukraine that started in 2014, if we are honest, with the annexation of Crimea, that those wars could have been avoided with a clearer NATO strategy towards these countries, Ukraine and Georgia?
Well, two thoughts. So first, briefly, and then one longer. The first thing is that what happened at the NATO Bucharest summit in 2008 was the worst of all worlds. At this point, pretty much everyone agrees on that. Just for your listeners, at the NATO Bucharest summit of 2008, after a long internal messy fight, the NATO communique stated that Ukraine and Georgia will become members, period. So that's now an official NATO position. But then NATO did absolutely nothing about it. So this was really the worst of all worlds because it created this expectation that it would happen, but it didn't. So there's disappointment and bitterness. It also enraged Putin. Putin knew that NATO does not like to take on members that have active conflicts on their territory. Mm-hmm. And so Putin thought, well, I can create one of those. Mm-hmm. So Putin invaded Georgia. So this was really the worst of all worlds. It would have been better either to say nothing or to really move to membership instead of doing what happened. So that is really unfortunate. But then a longer, more comprehensive response, I wouldn't phrase it in terms of could we avoid the specific war or not. The way I would phrase it is, could we have created a timeline to the future where it was unlikely that you would have major military conflict with Russia? And I think the answer is a qualified yes. It's qualified because, of course, as we've been discussing, Russian leaders make, sadly, repeatedly, extreme self-harming choices. But the big play in post-Cold War Europe was to achieve three things. First, to let the new democracies in Central and Eastern Europe join NATO. Second, to find some kind of place for Ukraine in a European security order. And third, to keep the strategic nuclear disarmament with Russia going. And so the big play was to do all those three things, let Central and Eastern Europe and NATO give Ukraine a berth, and keep cooperation with Russia going. Instead, we only accomplished one of those. Mm-hmm. We only got Central and Eastern Europe into NATO, which is a good thing, but we did not find ways to make that happen while defining a berth for Ukraine and keeping cooperation with Russia going. Mm-hmm. And I believe my colleague Fiona Hill, who is also a historian as well as a policymaker, I think she's on the right track there with her article. I don't know that article, but I do agree with it. So my argument is that not so much specifically could we avoid this conflict, but we could have found a context that would have made it possible to achieve more of those three goals than we did, instead of leaving Ukraine in the lurch. That does not mean everything would be perfect now. That does not mean it would be all wine and roses now. But the timeline we're on, the one we actually have, is pretty bad. I mean, we have major great power war. The immensity of the war crimes in Ukraine is unspeakable. The only worst timeline would be one that involves nuclear weapons. So could we have gotten on a better timeline to the future? I believe yes, because the one we're on is awful. Mm-hmm. And so I think if we had kept going with the Partnership for Peace, it doesn't mean things would be perfect, but we would have had more options for managing contingency than we do now. Because now it's just all or nothing NATO membership, and we're stuck with this hard choice. You know, do you put NATO in Ukraine and NATO or not? That's a hard choice. Mm-hmm. If you had this intermediate organization, it would have given, you know, it gives you more opportunity to manage flexibility. I should say the Partnership for Peace does still exist on paper, but it's not important.
No, it's not an issue anymore. Yeah. Especially not with the war that we see unfolding in right. front of our right. eyes for 1.5 years now. We have already spoken about NATO, or you have already mentioned that, you know, NATO has tremendously changed since February 22. What would you say? I mean, it was a couple of years ago that the French president said that NATO is dead. I mean, obviously, NATO is very much alive right now, again. What are the biggest changes that you observe within NATO that happened after Russia invaded Ukraine?
It's funny that you mentioned that quote from French President Macron. I remember, this is going back now, obviously more than a year and a half, when people would ask me, what are you working on? And I would say, I'm working on a book on NATO. I would more or less get the response, sometimes politely, sometimes not so politely, along the lines of, you seem like a smart person. Why are you working on such an outdated topic? And I would try to explain, no, I really think NATO matters, and I'm really worried that there's going to be conflict with Russia, and I think this is important. That's why I'm devoting my time to it. So I wasn't surprised when Macron said that, because I was, you know, hearing similar things myself. But it became apparent to me in the course of my research just how much Putin likes to use violence to mark historical anniversaries. I mean, I'm not the only person to notice this, but I saw it in great detail because I was working with all these sources. To cite just a few examples, the very brave human rights activist Anna Politkovskaya, one of the few people brave enough to report from Chechnya on these terrible crimes, which, of course, now tragically we know were a precursor to Mariupol. One day when she was carrying home her groceries, she was shot multiple times at close range, presumably by a professional killer. And that day was October 7th, 2006, Putin's birthday. Putin noted in a speech afterward that she was, quote, a very unimportant person, which I thought was an interesting paradox, that the president of a country would note how unimportant someone was.
Yes, indeed.
And then fast forward 10 years, the leak of the emails hacked from the Hillary Clinton campaign by Russian military intelligence, October 7th, 2016, again, Putin's birthday. For his 70th birthday this past year, October 7th, 2022, Putin tried to give himself the present of 40,000 square miles of Ukraine by announcing the annexation of territories that Russia did not then control and still does not. So you see this clear pattern. Also, he likes to mark things like the birthday of Peter the Great and so forth. So as I was researching my book, one of the reasons why I was doing it, and when people, you know, would say to me, that's an outdated topic, I would say no, is I was trying to figure out when I went to publish all this research, because I'd been doing this for years. And I looked at the calendar and I realized in late 2021, early 2022, would be the 30th anniversary of Ukraine breaking away, the Soviet Union falling apart, and all the chaos that happened. And given this clear pattern of using violence on important dates, it was just clear to me there was no way Putin was going to ignore that date. Now, I didn't know he was going to try to take Kyiv in 3 days, right? I didn't, you know, I'm not psychic, but it was just clear to me that there was a pattern. And that's why I believe very much on the power of history, not only to understand the past, but also to help us see what's coming over the horizon in the future. I don't think we can predict the future, but I do believe we can prepare for it. And the best way that I know to do that is to do historical work, to recognize patterns, and then prepare for them to repeat themselves in the future. And so that's why I'm a historian. And so it was clear to me as a historian that NATO was not dead. And it was clear to me that Russian aggression was not dead. And so I think what's happening now is that you mentioned your question, to come back to your question about changes in NATO. I think NATO, it's not so much that NATO has changed, because NATO is now reverting to its core mission of defending.
New members coming up, members that hadn't probably thought about joining NATO.
That
before.
Is true, but NATO has expanded in the past and it will expand again. So even that is a continuity. I think what has really changed are the attitudes towards NATO. To cite just one personal example, you and I are recording this in Hamburg, but I was in Berlin at the beginning of the week. And I was walking through the district Berlin-Mitte. I was walking up Tucholsky Street. This is Tucholsky Straße. This is a street where, you know, there in past have been, you know, left radical squatters, things like that. And hanging out of the windows on that street were Ukrainian flags, but there was also a NATO flag hanging out of a window in the middle of Berlin at Tucholsky Street. And I thought that just shows how the attitudes have changed.
Mary, my last question to you in this podcast episode, I mean, you triggered this somehow because you described so nicely why you are a historian and why you think history matters to not to predict the future, but to develop a roadmap. And,
yes.
And we are recording this podcast in Hamburg in Germany, and that is a country where our chancellor, like in February 22, has announced the era of Zeitenwende. And so I'm curious, I mean, Zeitenwende describes a process, you know, the times are changing, but things are yet unclear. So we are in an era of change. Mm. You have also said the post-war era is over. It has ended with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Are we already fit enough? Do we already know enough to find a name for the new era we are in? I mean, Zeitenwende obviously cannot stay with us for the next 5 or 10 years. So how would you describe the era we are in?
Mm. Yeah, that's a difficult question. As I said, the post-Cold War era also needs a name. The post-Cold War era is over. It's not entirely clear when it ended, though. And I think defining when that ended will also help us to define this era. The post-Cold War era was roughly the time between the end of the Cold War and COVID, roughly. You could argue perhaps ended with Donald Trump, who was the first president to call American membership in NATO into question. You could argue it ended in 2008 with Georgia. I believe the Columbia political scientist Michael Doyle has argued that it ended in 2012, because that's both when Putin came back to the presidency mm-hmm. and Xi Jinping came to power. Mm-hmm. So it's not clear yet, but it is clear that it's over. And that, I think, was an era of optimism about great power relations that has faded. And so I believe the era we have now is the era of the return of history.
That's interesting, yeah, because in comparison to Francis Fukuyama, who announced the end of history in 1989, you know, with the end of the coming down of the wall and the end of communism. So you would say it's the return of history?
Yes, and I'm not alone in that, by the way. My friend and colleague, Serhii Plohy, who is himself Ukrainian and a professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard, he's about to publish a book about the Russian-Ukraine conflict. I'm looking forward to it very much. It isn't out yet, but I believe the subtitle is something like The Russian-Ukrainian War, The Return of History. So this is a sentiment that many historians are sharing. This is obviously promising for us as scholars because there is interest on our work. And there is interest in our work, as shown by the fact that, you know, we're here recording this podcast. But it is also deeply tragic that great power conflict has reignited, that the history of military conflict in Europe is now present again. So I don't say that with any happiness as a human being, but as a scholar, I do believe very much we are witnessing the return of history.
Thank you very much, Mary, for this conversation. It was extremely insightful, and thank you for joining the History and Politics podcast.
Sure, thank you so much.
This was our History and Politics episode with Mary Elisa Rotti on the end of the post-war order and on the question, what comes next? If you are interested in Mary Sorotti's writings, we have put some information for you in the show notes. If you'd like to listen to other English language episodes of our podcast, just scroll in your podcatcher and you'll easily find a couple of episodes of our special series, The New Germany, that deals with the multiple aspects of Zeitenwende in Germany and also beyond Germany. Thank you so much for listening. If you like our podcast, we'd be very happy if you subscribe to it or if you'd recommend it to others. If you are interested in the other work of the History and Politics Department, please check out our website at www.koerber-stiftung.de. Stay tuned, all the best, and goodbye. Tschüss from Hamburg.